Okay, we got to get started. Got a lot to cover. I mentioned last time we got into this area of variations on polarography. And I'm not going to belabor that, but that's what we're into. We're into, first of all, if it's polarography, it involves a dropping mercury electrode. So I'm going to cover just a couple of things that have used that dropping mercury electrode. Then I'm going to get back into straight voltammetry. In other words, no dropping mercury electrode. Same experimental principle, voltage applied, current measured, just different electrode. All right? So the first one I mentioned was AC polarography, where instead of just a straight potential versus time applied voltage to the electrode, I'm superimposing a sine wave on top of that. That becomes important because in the vicinity of the E1/2, in potentials where there's an actual where you get near the reduction of the species of interest, you're going to get reduction, oxidation, reduction. Okay, so that's going to change the way things are done a little bit, or the resulting waveform that you get out, the output waveform. So it says here, nothing happens below the E1/2, reduction occurs above the E1/2. We cross that line back and forth as we do this sine wave, and we get a fluctuation in the amount of current that is produced, or as a matter of fact, we get a fluctuation in the direction of the current. Sometimes it's positive current, sometimes it's negative. We get the reverse reaction occurring. Okay, so we talked about that. If we measure the AC component of that current, okay, just the fact that sometimes the current's positive, sometimes it's negative, so it's fluctuating. Prior to the E1/2, prior to reaching a potential at which anything happens, you have a steady state nothing, right? A steady state, no reaction occurring. So there is no AC component. It's a steady component. Beyond the E1/2, when you're so far above the E1/2 that even the fluctuations in the sine wave don't go below but keep you above the E1/2, you have a steady positive current. So there's no AC component there either. So there's only an AC component in the vicinity. So I get nothing, then I get an AC component, then I get nothing. And so the idea is that in this type of, this is DC polarography, let's see, AC polarography, here we are. So this is where we are. We did DC polarography first, straight scan, and then this funny looking sawtooth wave because of the drops. Then we did cyclic voltammetry, or we did actually cyclic voltammetry beforehand, where we went up and down and on a solid electrode, not a dropping electrode, and we got these kind of a waveform. Now we're doing AC polarography, where we've got this sine wave, and we get a peak, not a wave. Right? These two things use the same electrode, but the difference is DC versus AC, right? A flat scan versus the sine wave kind of a thing. And so I get a peak rather than a wave. I don't have I still have the drop. You know, the drop is still dropping. Okay, and so I still see these fluctuations on there as well. I talked a little bit about pulsed waveforms last time, and here's two examples of pulses that can be used, and I'll talk a little bit more. I'll review that really quickly. AC tells you about the frequency here. Magnitude 10 volts peak to peak. It does improve the detection limits slightly over the DC experiment. It produces a peak, and you get multiple peaks if you have multiple components. You can do AC voltammetry without using the dropping mercury electrode. Same applied waveform, different electrode. I then told you last time about phase selective AC polarography. And it's just a variation on that AC polarography that takes advantage of the fact that the applied, the Faraday current and the applied potential scan actually are actually in phase with one another. Let's see. Okay. So I apply this kind of a sine wave. The waves are a little ugly because I drew them by hand myself. Okay. But anyway, I have an applied sine wave. My Faradaic current goes up and down depending on what my applied potential does. But my capacitive current in red does not follow the Faradaic current, but lags the Faradaic current. So if this is if this were a scale, now we can of course convert degrees to radians, right? And so we can. This says it's a time axis, but if we talk about it in terms of degrees or radians, this is a sine wave, right? So this is one wave. This is 180. Okay, this is 360. This is 90, roughly. Okay, so I didn't draw it very well, but it says capacitive current lags the voltage by 90 degrees. So the capacitive current, this red curve, is lagging behind the Faradaic current. So when I get to the point where I'm actually converting the species from ox to red, the Faradaic current goes up. And when I... at the same time, capacitive current is charging. Okay, the electrode is charging. And my capacitive current goes up also, but it's slow. The capacitive current takes time for those ions to migrate. Because remember, capacitive current is based on a double layer or a layer of positive and negative ions if the electrode is negatively charged as it is in reduction, then positive ions migrate to that electrode and negative ions migrate to the other electrode. Well, that whole effect of migrating ions charging up the electrode surface into a layered, ordered system, that takes some time, and so that capacitive current develops slowly. And if it develops slowly, that means in the time scale, it lags behind the Faradaic current. Well, I can use that to my advantage because I want to measure Faradaic current and I don't want to measure capacitive current. I want to minimize capacitive current. So what I do is I make my measurements at these points where there are circles, and it says measure the current where the I capacitive is a minimum. Okay, and that's the whole idea behind phase selective AC polarography. Now, that same concept, let's see what else we got here. Okay, so I measure in a place in the cycle where a capacitive is a minimum, the Faradaic is a maximum. I get about a tenfold improvement in sensitivity. We can do this on different electrodes, dropping mercury, solid electrodes, whatever. But then we get into the pulsed waveform. So I'm morphing from one technique into the other. I'm segueing here, right? Going from one technique to another. I mentioned already these two pulses. If we have pulsed voltammetry of some form, and I'm lumping all pulsed voltammetry together because there are many types of pulses that you could apply. Basically, electrochemists got to this point where they said, hey, we can do these pulses and get a different result. Same experiment, same experimental setup. Didn't change a thing, but I'm applying a different pulsed waveform, just like you do in NMR or some other experiment where you apply different signals to the sample. Well, now we're doing electrochemistry, and we're applying different signals to the electrode that's measuring the species of interest. My big deal is I got to get rid of capacitive current and measure the Faradaic current. So what do? Well, I start applying different pulses and measuring the current at different times after the pulse or during the pulse, and I can make big pulses, I can make little pulses, I can pulse this way, I can pulse that way, I can pulse behind my back, I can pulse when I'm standing on my head, I can do all different types of applied waveforms. Here's two of them right here, where I take the potential ramp that I had before, and I put little pulses, little square pulses, on top of that potential waveform. Well, that's going to give me a different output than just a straight potential waveform. What if I don't like those little dinky little wimpy pulses? I want big manly pulses like these, okay? So I say, okay, I'm going to have a pulse and then I'm going to go back to zero. And I'm going to have another pulse, and I'm going to go back to zero. And I'm going to increase that pulse with time. Now, if I make a measurement, and this is basically what this represents, if I make the measurement on top of the pulse, okay, what difference does it make if I'm measuring here and measuring here, measuring here and measuring here, okay? What difference does it make which one of these two pulses that I apply? If I'm only measuring at these points, what difference does it make? Well, it actually does make a difference. Because when I apply a steady ramp of current, excuse me, of potential, my capacitive current is building, charging, charging, charging. When I pulse up like this and come back down, the capacitive current begins to flow, and then it stops. Then I pulse again, and the capacitive current begins to flow, but then I trick it, and I go back down to zero again. I jump up high, and I begin to get capacitive current, but then I go back down, and the capacitive current stops. So these two things are similar, but they actually give you a different result. The one on the bottom... Oh, I didn't mean to do that. The one on the bottom is integral, sometimes referred to as integral pulse or normal pulse polarography or voltammetry. And we'll talk about this as maybe differential pulse polarography or voltammetry. Now, this is, I think, where I left off last time. Here's what happens. I think there's animation here, and you have the slide, so we can skip through this. Whoops, I didn't mean to skip that fast. What's happening during the pulse sequence? What happens when I pulse, when I apply a potential pulse to my electrode? Okay, here's my applied potential. I got these pulses, all right, blue pulses. What I've decided to do is I'm only going to measure the current in a window at the end of the pulse. Okay, so I'm integrating the current that is produced during that little window. The rest of the time, I'm applying a voltage to the system, but I'm discarding. I don't care about the current. I'm just going to let it go, and I don't even want to know what it is. But during this, now in reality, I'm going to tell you what it is. But I'm only going to measure during that little window. The Faradaic current, okay, the second set of peaks here, we know according to the Cottrell equation is if I'm in the vicinity of the E1/2, I'm going to get an increase in the current, and then it's going to drop off over time, according to the Cottrell equation. I'm doing voltammetry. I'm not stirring. So it's a Cottrell equation, diffusion control type system. And I'm waiting, and I'm seeing what happens. I get a current, but the current drops off. I know that my capacitive current, bottom graph, spikes up and begins to flow. And I probably should have showed a little bit of lag time there. But then it drops off exponentially. It actually drops off according to an exponential decay. So, and again, I could, to be really correct, I should have put a lag time because the capacitive current lags the Faradaic current by 90 degrees. So I could have lagged, I could have put the peak over here and dropped off, okay? But the point is that I'm going to measure when the capacitive current has minimized itself, has dropped off. I still have some Faradaic current. It's less than it was at the beginning, but my capacitive current is a lot less. And therefore, I am minimizing, if I'm only measuring in this window over here, if I'm only measuring here, I'm measuring where the Faradaic current is still significant, and my capacitive current in this plot I've shown it gone to zero. Of course, it doesn't go completely to zero, but it goes to a minimum. All right, so I pulse along, and I'm measuring only at the end of the pulse. This is what we're going to do. Let's see. All that animation is in my way. This is what I'm going to do in my typical pulsed experiment. I'm going to measure not the entire pulse, but at the end of the pulse. Okay, I'm going to measure at the end of the pulse. And this turns out to be a good way to do the experiment. Okay. Pulse polarography. Only measure current during the latter part of the pulse, end of the pulse. take advantage of the fact that the capacitive current decays more rapidly than the Faradaic current, improves my detection limits to 10 to the minus 7th molar. Now, if you've been following this, we've been sort of getting tenfold increases in sensitivity. Maybe DC polarography, 10 to the minus 5th. AC polarography, 10 to the minus 6th. Pulse polarography, 10 to the minus 7th. I'm improving by an order of magnitude every time I do some permutation here. Okay? Very easy to accomplish this with modern instrumentation. As a matter of fact, in recent years, the new wave in electrochemical instrumentation is, it's this way in all instrumentation, right? You buy your computer, because everybody has to have a computer, probably. If we took a census, we'd probably find out that for every person in the United States of America, there are 3 or 4 computers, right? You know, you got one at home, you got one in your office, you got one, you know, in your bathroom, I don't know. Anyway, so you got a whole bunch of computers, right? So you buy a computer, and then you buy this little box that has a USB connector on it, because everything has a USB connector on it today, right? And you plug it into your computer, and this little box does the electrochemistry, actually applies the potential waveform. So you got 3 wires coming out for your 3 electrode system, and you set up your electrochemical cell, and you connect the 3 wires, and you put some software on your computer, and it runs, it does the electrochemistry for you. So you just watch it on the screen, selecting your waveform, looking at the output wave, and so forth. And everything's done by this little tiny box that's USB, USB 2.0, plugs into your computer, and applies the potentials and measures the current. That's the latest permutation. In the old days, when I was a graduate student, you had a separate box. You had to buy, and there was no computer connected to it. I got into the time when you bought a box that controlled the potentials, and you maybe had a separate box if you had to do cyclic voltammetry. You had a wave generator that generated the triangle wave up, down to give you cyclic voltammetry. Or if you were going to do pulse, some kind of pulse voltammetry or pulse polarography, you had to buy a box that applied the pulses. You had a basic potentiostat, and then you had a recorder that actually drew on paper and gave you your results. Now, all of that stuff, it's all the same. It's all doing the same experiments, just different electronics and different trend in what we're doing. So modern, I guess one of the things I wanted to bring out is electrochemical instrumentation is actually very inexpensive compared to spectroscopy or other techniques. You could probably for $5,000 or $10,000 get yourself a whole system to do any kind of electrochemistry you want. You want to buy a spectrometer? Okay, you're gonna have to pay a lot more money than that. Now you could buy a little cheap. You want to buy a nice chromatographic instrumentation, you know, HPLC or GC, you're going to pay $50,000. You want to buy a state-of-the-art electrochemistry, you could probably do it for $10,000. And so it's very inexpensive compared to other techniques. All right, we saw all this. Let's see. Let's say that, okay, maybe it was something here. Okay, in polarography, what we often do is we synchronize the drop. So it's a dropping mercury electrode, drop, drop, drop. We synchronize the drop with the pulses. All right, so here we have first drop, second drop, third drop. How do you do that? You get a little device. I don't have a picture of one. Synchronized drops, okay. You use what's called a drop knocker. It's a little man, it's about this tall, has a hammer. And he comes out and he knocks the drop off the end of the capillary tube. Okay, if you believe me, don't even come for the exam. Okay, actually, a drop knocker is a solenoid actuated device that hits the side of the capillary where the drop is coming out, and it knocks the drop off, and so that we can synchronize the drop with the applied waveform. So I'm going to get a big fat drop hanging off the end of my... So the drop starts out and is nothing, and it grows and grows and grows till it's really big, and then I knock it off. Meanwhile, I've synchronized my pulse with that drop. Okay, so now I am synchronizing my dropping mercury electrode with all of this measurement current, the current that I'm measuring, so that I can get the best possible result from my dropping mercury electrode and my pulsed voltammetry experiment. Now, this tells you about 40 milliseconds long. The pulses are typically 40 milliseconds long. They apply the pulse late in the drop life. That's what we just saw, right? So this is a 40 millisecond peak distance time on the time axis. It's late in the drop life, and let's see what else it says here. The point of measurement is at the end of the applied pulse. So I'm actually measuring in that little window at the end of the pulse. So I got three things going on. I got the drop, I've got the pulse, and then I've got the measurement. Okay? And they're all in sequence, but all the action is at the end. All right? Okay. Pulse amplitude increases with time, eventually reaching the E1/2 value. So this is the integral pulse situation. At the end of the pulse, the applied signal returns to the baseline level. That's what goes on here. And if we do it that way, we get a wave. Okay. Now, you can't see it in this diagram, but the wave actually has steps in it. Okay. That wave has steps in it because of the pulses, all right? And you say, well, what about the drops? Well, the pulses are more significant here than the drops because we're measuring here and here and here and here and here and here, okay? And so each time we measure, we get a jump in the current. There's more current. Again, in the vicinity of the E1/2. Out here, there's nothing. We get nothing. And once we get way above the E1/2, I got the current all the time. I got the same current all the time because every pulse is way above the E1/2, and it gives me it's converting ox to red, so I get the same current all the time. It's only in the vicinity of the E1/2 that I get these steps. Okay, I get this wave and the steps that occur. Okay, so this is the integral pulse and the kind of the waveform, the output waveform. So I might ask you this on the exam. What kind of pulse is that? What technique is that? Well, it's either integral or normal. That's the two names for this type of a pulse. And the output waveform is a wave, but it has steps on it. Okay. Here's another picture of it. Again, I called it normal here. Normal pulse polarography, steps, same thing, wave. Right? DC polarography, well, we saw this already. Here's a comparison of the two, DC polarography and normal pulse polarography, and there's the little steps on the wave. Okay, same idea. Okay, same thing going on here in these two experiments, except we got pulses versus a constant ramp. So instead of having the constant ramp, I've got pulses. That's all. Differential pulse polarography. Here's a variation that improves on the pulse polarography experiment by doing what's called a differential pulse. Now, this is the differential idea is one of those advances that came along. Somebody came up with this good idea, and they said, I've got an idea. How about we take the difference between what's happening at the beginning or before the pulse is applied and then at the end? Now, in the past, in the previous things that I told you about, we were only doing this, right? We were applying E versus time, and we were applying a pulse, and then we said we were measuring late in the pulse. Well, down here, we're measuring current, so we're measuring down here. We're measuring that little window at the end of the pulse, and we were doing it to get the Faradaic, primarily, after the capacitive had dropped off. Now, I'm going to compare that measurement at point B, okay, this measurement at point B, with the current at point A, before the pulse is applied. And I've got capacitive current before the pulse is applied because if I'm doing a ramp like this, I'm building capacitive current all the time. So if I measure the capacitive current before the pulse, then I can subtract out, I measure current before the pulse, and I can subtract out some of the capacitive current. from the component of capacitive current that I measure at the end of the pulse. So I'm going to subtract A from B. Okay, what happens is I get a nice peak. I get a nice peak, and I get, again, better discrimination or differentiation between the Faradaic and capacitive current. And this is differential pulse, and we do the same thing as we synchronize the drops with the pulses, and we now have an experiment, a differential pulse experiment, that's better than the normal pulse or integral pulse situation that I told you where we had the big pulses, but we went back down to zero, okay, each time. So here, different waveform, different output waveform, all right, differential pulse. Okay. Normal pulse versus differential pulse, just different pictures. These are those pulses, okay? And they show you a little circle, and they say, okay, these are actually big pulses, but if I compress the time scale, they look like spikes. Well, they're really square pulses, right? And if I measure at the end, the little dot represents where I measure at the end of the pulse, but in differential pulse, I measure at the beginning and the end, both, right? I get a wave up here, I get a peak down here. Right? Now, I'm not asking you to, you say, well, if I had to explain why you get a wave sometimes and get a peak sometimes, I'm not sure I'd understand it. Well, I've explained it in a basic way. I've given you handout material. Okay, every lecture has some handouts with it that you can look at and read up on this. But I do want you to know something about these different experiments. The normal pulse experiment, the differential pulse experiment, the waveform that's applied, the resulting waveform that you get out, what these things look like. And obviously, I mentioned before, both of these would have steps on them. Like that. Or here, you would have little steps. Again, you can't see these because it's at a high sensitivity. If I could draw, I'd draw it, but I can't draw. I'm going to keep my day job. Okay, this is an example. You can start to see the little wavies on the side of this differential pulse. This is differential pulse polarography versus a saturated calomel electrode, and doesn't tell us what it is, but it's at negative 1 volt. Negative 1 volt is probably zinc. It's probably zinc. That's my guess. Okay. And this is a hydrogen wave. H plus. That would be my guess. Anyway. Okay. What else do we have? Applied potential waveform. Again, okay. So we're applying this ramp. We're putting pulses on it. All right. This is from some manufacturer's literature. And they tell you here that, okay, the mercury drop is dislodged at the end of the pulse, right there. So they got a drop dislodger, a drop knocker, a little guy with a hammer. Okay. And he's knocking the drops off. Meanwhile, if I'm going to do the differential pulse experiment, I'm going to measure prior to the pulse. So there's a 17 millisecond window prior to the pulse that I'm going to measure the current. Then I'm going to put a pulse of 60 milliseconds on this potential scan. So 60 millisecond pulse. And then I'm going to measure the current at the last 17 milliseconds. And you say, what's magic about 17 milliseconds? Nothing. As a matter of fact, in a research-grade electrochemical instrument, like maybe if you bought you paid $10,000 and you got the box and you got the computer and you got the software, you'd be able to change all these. You could make it 16 milliseconds, or you could make it 20 milliseconds, or you could change the pulse width. You could make it a 30 millisecond pulse or 120 millisecond pulse. You can vary the pulse widths and the windows over which you integrate the signal, and you can have control over all the variables. Now, what this is a manufacturer's literature, and they've said, this is what we do. We built our system with this standard 60 millisecond pulse and a 17 millisecond integration time because we found that to be good for a lot of different experiments. But you have control over this in electrochemistry, and you can change those things. You can optimize them. You want to optimize. You want to run some kind of a, you know, you got a dozen variables that you could optimize. The rate at which you scan, the pulse height, the width peak, the width of the pulse, the peak to peak frequency of the pulse, the window at which you over which you integrate, all kinds of things you have control over in these experiments, and you could optimize all of those different parameters to determine what are the best parameters for your particular situation. Or if you're like most people, you just use what the default ones are, and you get the result, and you go home and have dinner. I don't know. Anyway, So this is typical for a manufacturer's type system. Advantages to differential pulse polarography: it gives well-resolved peaks. When you start pulsing things, you're able to get better resolution between E1 halves that are very close together. So here it says, well-resolved peaks can determine species that have E1 halves as close as 40 millivolts apart. That's pretty close. Remember, we can do about, with mercury and several electrodes, we have a window of about 1,000 millivolts, about a 1-volt scan, from about 0 to negative 1 on the reducing side of things. We can go sometimes a little below 0, or into the positive side, I guess, and we can go beyond negative 1, negative 1.2, or something like that. But it's about a 1 volt or 1,000 millivolt range over which we can do the electrochemistry. There is, if I can have 40 millivolt resolution, I can see lots of different things. I've seen people do 7 different metals in one scan. 7 different metals in that 1,000 millivolt scan with getting good resolution to measure those individual metals. Right. In differential pulse polarography, we get detection limits to 10 to the minus 8th molar. Getting better. We keep increasing. It's pretty fast with a modern dropping mercury electrode. Scan rates are 10 to 50 millivolts a second in that range, and the instrumentation is on this order in terms of expense. You could probably buy a simple, inexpensive, you could probably buy a cheap student model electrochemistry setup for less than $5,000, for maybe $2,000. Okay. You could buy a research-grade system for probably $10,000. If you want to spend more money than that, you know, you're going to have to buy something else. Okay. I'm going to talk to you. There's only two techniques left. Right? That doesn't mean I'll end, but I'll certainly use up all the available time. The next technique I'm going to talk about is anodic stripping voltammetry, as it says here. What I want to impress upon you is that all of the techniques that we've talked about so far, what I started out with electrogravimetry, or we called it controlled potential electrolysis, we talked about chronoamperometry, chronopotentiometry, coulometry, polarography, variations on voltammetry, stirred and unstirred, pulsed polarography or pulsed voltammetry, differential pulse, integral pulse or normal pulse. Now I'm getting into, I guess I talked about AC polarography versus DC polarography. Okay, all those different techniques, people use those techniques. DC polarography, almost nobody does plain vanilla DC polarography. They do variations on it, differential pulse polarography, for example. The two techniques I'm going to talk to you about next, anodic stripping voltammetry and square wave voltammetry, are the two most widely used techniques today. They are extremely sensitive, and they are the most modern versions of these. All of the combined knowledge that we've gotten from doing electrochemistry for 200 years, okay, people have been doing electrochemistry, probably longer than they've been doing spectroscopy, although I suppose we could argue about that. If spectroscopy is, looking at the sun and taking a magnifying glass and starting fires with it or something. I suppose if that's spectroscopy, then maybe people have been doing that longer. But electrochemistry's been done for a long time. But the anodic stripping voltammetry is one of the most widely used techniques today because primarily of its extreme sensitivity. Okay. Anodic stripping voltammetry combines two techniques, two things that we already learned about. So it's really just a combination of two things that we've seen before. You could argue that it's three things, but let's not make it too confusing, all right? The first step in anodic stripping voltammetry is electrodeposition. Remember when we did electrogravimetry or that controlled potential electrolysis, and I said to you, one of the things that you can do with this technique is you can pre-concentrate the sample. So, if I'm an oceanographer and I want to measure the amount of lead in the ocean, okay, because I heard that lead is in the atmosphere and it's being sent up the smokestacks of incinerators and it's blowing out to sea and depositing on the ocean, and I want to know how much lead is out in the ocean. I want to know if it's more lead in the surface, where it's coming out of the sky, you know, being washed out or rained out from the atmospheric deposition. And then I want to take a sample down low at depth, you know, 100 meters down, and find out if it's lower down there. And I want to compare those two. Do you know what the concentration of lead in the ocean is? It's somewhere in the neighborhood of about 10 to the minus 10th molar. Okay, 10 to the minus 10th. That's not much. Okay, that's small. And you would be pretty hard-pressed to find a technique that would be able to measure 10 to the minus 10th molar lead, but anodic stripping voltammetry will do it. And the way in which it does it is the oceanographer grabs a sample, okay, takes a sample, and that sample might be somewhat large, a large sample, and he puts it into his electrochemical cell and he does the electrodeposition or the pre-concentration step. He plates out the lead that's in the sample into his electrode. Maybe it's a mercury electrode, maybe it's not a mercury electrode. But he plates out the lead, concentrating the lead onto the electrode surface. Right? That's the first step. So, electrodeposition done at constant potential. Lead deposits at some value, negative, I don't know, 0.4 volts or something like that. And so I just go more negative than that, and I plot, or I plate out the amount of lead that I want for some amount of time. Now, I do it with stirring because I want mass transfer to be efficient. I want to get as much lead onto my electrode as I can. So I stir. It says plate 100%. Now, if we were plating 100%, we'd be doing electrogravimetry kind of experiment. Typically, they don't do 100%. Okay. Typically, either plate 100% onto or into the electrode, or plate with reproducible stirring for a known time interval. That's really the way this is done. I see this all the time in this textbook, so I put it in here. I've never, in practice, seen anybody plate out 100% of the metal. It takes too long. You'd have to wait a day. And if your electrode, remember we did it before with a pool of mercury in the electrogravimetry, in the controlled potential electrolysis, when I said you were purifying a solution, you put a pool of mercury. We need a big area in order to plate out all of the stuff. We don't have that. We have a little electrode with a little area. So it's better for us to plate out the lead for a fixed period of time reproducibly. Stir reproducibly, measure the time reproducibly, and measure and deposit only a fixed amount of the lead, a certain amount. Maybe we're only getting a few percent of the lead. Maybe we're only getting less than 1% of the lead. But we're concentrating it because it's so low at 10 to the minus 10th molar in the ocean that we need to pre-concentrate it. So I apply a constant potential, known time interval, reproducible stirring, and I pre-concentrate the lead. Then, once I've got the lead concentrated onto the electrode surface, whether it's a mercury drop, if it's actually a mercury drop, it plates out on the mercury and amalgamates into the mercury and dissolves. Or if it's a solid electrode, it just plates out on the surface and we get little atoms of lead on the surface of the electrode. Then I turn around and I scan the potential from the negative potential that plated out the lead. I scan in a positive direction, anodic, right? I'm going oxidizing. And I strip off the lead from PB 0, okay, to Pb2 plus, plus 2 electrons. Okay, that's my experiment. If lead's what I'm after, then I plated it first to concentrate it. Now that I've gotten it concentrated on the electrode surface, I strip it off. I do the experiment where I scan to more oxidizing potentials, positive direction. Everything we've been doing lately for most of the classes so far has been cathodic type experiments, reducing type experiments. Now I'm oxidizing. Now I'm scanning the other way. I'm scanning from negative potentials to positive potentials, and I'm oxidizing the lead to lead ions and stripping it off of the electrode surface in order to measure the amount of current produced from this reaction. Okay? That is a anodic stripping voltammetry. That's how it's done. The key to the whole experiment is the deposition. If I pre-concentrate or deposit the material, I increase its concentration. So I can get the 10 to the minus 10th molar lead with no problem. Okay, no problem. All right. This is what it looks like. You say, wow, that's weird. Linear scan anodic stripping voltammetry. What am I doing? I told you that in electrogravimetry or controlled potential electrolysis or in chronoamperometry, all of those experiments, or even in the coulometry experiment, we hold the potential at a certain value versus time. It just stays constant. Well, that's what this is talking about right here. With time, I keep it constant. I pick a value that's suitable to reduce the material that I want, the lead or copper or cadmium or zinc or whatever I'm interested in. I set the potential, and then I just plate, constant potential. Okay? Then I do a linear potential scan. So I call it linear scan ASV here, because in a minute I'm going to change things on you. So I'm emphasizing the fact that it's a linear scan. And that linear scan happens to be down. Why down? Because previously I told you that E versus time, we were going negative. Remember I drew I drew an axis for you, and I said in the convention of electrochemists we plot the cathodic things up in this quadrant. All right? So if we're going to do a negative scan, we go this way. If we're going to do a positive scan, we go this way. That's just the way electrochemists do things. Right. Likewise, remembering back to that E versus current plot I gave you, if I get when I scan in this direction, if I get a current, I have to plot it in this quadrant. So therefore, I got this kind of a output wave. Better clean this up there. All right, so let's read what this says. Well, you can read this on your own time. All right, so we whatever the metal is, we plate it out, converting it from the ion to the metal, and it's either plating out onto the surface of the electrode or it's dissolving into mercury. Then I strip it off, I oxidize it from the metal to the ion. Okay, I measure the current associated with that linear oxidizing or anodic scan, so it's called anodic stripping. What am I doing? I'm stripping off the metal that I plated onto the electrode. So it's anodic stripping voltammetry, and as I strip it off, I get peaks, and those peaks are typically plotted upside down because electrochemists do things upside down and backwards. Well, not really. But that's the way they decided to do it originally. Right? Now, I can easily change that. Because on my instrument that has lots of dials and knobs and switches, I can flip a switch and change the polarity and turn those peaks right side up. So if the electrochemists are feeling a little insecure and they say, gee, I want to be just like all my buddies, all my other chemist buddies, and all the chromatographers plot their peaks right side up, then I can flip a switch and turn the peaks right side up and everybody's happy. Okay, we all feel well adjusted, and everybody loves one another. Okay, so technically we're supposed to plot them upside down like this, like it's shown here, but we can flip them right side up. The reason I tell you that is because when anodic stripping voltammetry first came out, everybody did it the right way. But then, like I said, they got insecure and they wanted to be like their friends, and so they decided to flip them over, and now everybody plots them right side up, even though they're not supposed to. Okay? People don't always do what they're told to do. Right? It's just a lesson from life that I thought I'd bring in here. Okay? All right. So, that's anodic stripping voltammetry. It is done. I was going to bring in one of these electrodes today, and I couldn't find it this morning, so I don't think anybody stole it. I really don't think anybody would want it. But it's a anodic stripping voltammetry is done with a hanging mercury drop electrode sometimes. Now, you can use solid electrodes, I told you. I passed around, if you remember, long ago, several classes ago, I passed around solid electrodes, like a platinum electrode or a gold electrode, and a glassy carbon was just black, shiny. Okay, you can do it with those. All right. You can also use mercury. Mercury has some advantages to it. For example, what we do in this particular system is we put mercury in here. There's a little reservoir that holds about a few hundred microliters of mercury. And there's a capillary tube coming down out of there. And this is like a micrometer up here, and I dial this knob up here, and I can measure the exact volume of mercury that I'm spitting out the bottom. And there's a little drop of mercury there. This is not a dropping mercury electrode. This is a hanging mercury drop electrode. I'm going to use one drop. I'm going to dial out a perfectly sized drop. Okay, certain number of microliters of mercury is going to come out the bottom and hang there, stick there. I'm going to do my experiment on that. When I'm done with that experiment, I'm going to knock the drop off and dial out a new drop and do a new experiment. So I can use a new mercury electrode for every experiment, for every scan. There's an advantage to that. I don't have contaminants on my electrode. I don't worry about the surface getting fouled or gummed up. And mercury has some good properties, as we saw before, with the hydrogen overvoltage and all that. So this is what this is all about. Now, on the next slide, it just shows you that there's a little drop hanging on the end. All right, and that's how this is done. There's a thread of mercury and then a reservoir up in here. Okay, you make an electrical connection. I don't know where that is. I think that might be it right there. Could be this right here, though. I think it's probably this. You connect the wire to this, it's conductive, right? The mercury is conductive. And you do your experiment. Of course, you've got to have a reference electrode and a counter electrode and so forth. But this is a hanging mercury drop electrode. Okay. What else can we say? We can improve on standard run-of-the-mill anodic stripping voltammetry, the linear scan version, by putting a pulse on the linear scan. Okay, so now I'm combining three things, right? I'm combining the electrode deposition, the controlled potential electrolysis, that's this part right here. Then I'm doing voltammetry with a ramp, and then I'm putting a pulse on it. Okay, and by the way, since I'm putting a pulse on it, why don't I just put a differential pulse? Or in other words, why don't I take the measurement before and after, before the pulse and at the end of the pulse? And I'll get some improvements on the same improvements we talked about before I'll get for this experiment if I use the pulsed waveform. So now we're going to do DPASV, differential pulse anodic stripping voltammetry. Right? And again, remember this waveform. Okay, that's the applied waveform. This is what the resulting peaks look like. Okay, and here's a typical differential pulse anodic stripping voltammetry voltammogram showing the steps because of the differential pulse. All right, steps along the side. Okay, and showing cadmium, lead, copper. You know what? This is probably zinc over here. Zinc 2+. All right. There's probably a gigantic, since we're oxidizing, right? We're scanning. We plated over here and we're scanning in this direction. We're plated negative and we're scanning this way. This is probably going up to the gigantic mercury wave. Okay, but I don't know. There's no, it doesn't tell you what this is done with mercury, but that's probably what it is. Okay, but we can do this experiment, differential pulse. We get the little steps on the side because of that, because we're subtracting. So I do a pulse and I get a measurement. Then I do another pulse and I subtract and I get another measurement. Then I do another pulse and I subtract and I get another. So I'm jumping the current in steps. Right? And that's why I see those steps on the side of the peak. We can also use a thin film mercury electrode. Take one of those electrodes I passed around and plate a film of mercury on it and then do my experiment. As a matter of fact, some people plate the mercury separately and then do the experiment with their metals and plate the metals onto the mercury surface. Or in some permutations, people will add mercury to their sample. They'll take their sample that they want to measure copper, cadmium, lead, zinc, whatever in it, and they'll add mercury to the sample, and then they'll plate simultaneously the mercury and the copper, cadmium, lead, zinc, and all those things, and then they'll strip them off. But the presence of the mercury, again, provides a mercury surface for the electrochemistry. And so the other metals strip out first. The mercury comes out last, as we saw, as I tried to indicate to you here. Mercury is the last thing, and we're scanning from the left to the right. I guess we do a lot of things from the left to the right. Anyway, so a thin film mercury electrode is called a TFME, thin film mercury electrode, or a mercury film electrode, MFE. All right. Often it's on a carbon electrode. These days it would be glassy carbon. You could do it on some other electrodes as well. Okay. Let's see. Here's a beautiful differential pulse anodic stripping voltammogram, probably at fairly high concentration, so you can't see the. If you really use your imagination, you can see some little steps on there. But the sensitivity, the concentration of these things is so high, you probably the sensitivity is low, therefore you don't see the steps. And the other one I showed you, it was high sensitivity, so we saw the steps on the sides of the peaks. There are several metals in this scan. Okay, what's that? Could be antimony, Sb2+. Bismuth comes out in there somewhere also. Who cares about bismuth? The makers of Pepto-Bismol. Nobody else. But anyway, several metals in the scan, extremely sensitive. The hydrogen wave. Where's the hydrogen wave? Well, the hydrogen wave is over here. If mercury is over here, the hydrogen wave is over here. Okay. The presence of the hydrogen wave, how steep this slope is over here, is dependent on what? The pH. How much hydrogen there is. If I'm doing seawater, okay, this could be seawater. I told you, ASV is anodic stripping voltammetry is used for seawater because concentrations are low. You know what the pH of seawater is? Okay, take my course next semester. About 8.2. Right, unless you're in a coastal area where it's influenced by runoff from the land. But out in the open ocean, above 8, around 8, 8.2, 8.1, okay, that's pretty high pH. That's pretty low hydrogen ion concentration. If I do a scan at that pH, I'm probably not going to see much of a hydrogen wave because there's not much hydrogen there. There's hydrogen there. There's always hydrogen in water. But there's not much of it. Its concentration is very low because the pH is high. If I were to acidify this to pH 1, I would see something like I drew here. I'd see a big wave over here because of hydrogen evolution, the reduction of hydrogen. But no problem. I can see zinc, cadmium lead, copper. I mentioned bismuth, antimony, indium, a bunch of metals. Okay. If you don't use a mercury electrode, you could measure mercury because mercury will plate out, right? A bunch of metals. All right. Oh, hydrogen wave over here, mercury oxidation. So if I'm using mercury, I would have a mercury wave over here as I oxidize and get into the potentials where mercury would oxidize. All right. ASV or DPASV widely used, especially because of a high sensitivity. Longer plating times. You can plate for 30 seconds. You could play it for 10 minutes. You could play it for half an hour if you wanted to. And again, if you're out, if you're doing oceanography, the oceanographers sometimes take the anodic stripping instrument on the boat, right? And they take their graduate students with them, and they say, go down there into the bottom of the boat and measure those samples, and don't come back until they're done, right? And what's the student down there? Just a little side effect there. You know, sound effects and help you understand what it's like out at sea. So you can use long plating times, nanomolar or part per trillion, easy. Subpart per trillion, possible. Okay. Metals in seawater, lead in blood. Lead in blood, this used to be a big... There's a company down in Bedford, Massachusetts, right down the road here, that Environmental Science Associates, I think it's called, Environmental Science, ESA. The whole company was founded by a guy named Wayne Mattson, who graduated from MIT, did his PhD thesis in electrochemistry, decided that he wanted to start a company. At the same time, fortunate for Wayne, there was this big push back in the 70s, 1970s, where they were measuring lead in blood. Little kids, they were worried about kids eating lead paint and getting lead in their blood. And so they required, every time a kid went to a doctor's office, they pricked his finger and made him cry, and then they collected some of the blood, okay, maybe 50 microliters, which is about a drop of blood. And they send it off to ESA, and they would run it by anodic stripping voltammetry. They'd take the blood, they'd add some acid to it, they'd heat it on a hot plate and digest it, and then they would dilute it to just a couple of milliliters, and they'd measure the lead in the blood. They'd plate out the lead doing a deposition scan, and then they'd strip, and they'd measure the lead in blood, and they'd determine lead in blood concentrations that way. And his whole company was founded. He had hundreds of people sitting at these little electrochemical instruments measuring lead and blood analysis. They were hiring biologists. I mean, they were desperate if they were hiring biologists, let me tell you, to do chemistry, because they needed somebody who knew something about a laboratory, how to work a pipette and so forth. They trained them how to do the electrochemistry. And the guy made millions of dollars. Now, his company's still in business. They've reinvented themselves, and they do other things now. He even made electrochemical instrumentation for a while. But there wasn't money, enough money, and he couldn't make enough money at it. He wanted to be rich and famous. Well, he's rich. I don't know how famous he is, but he's rich. Lead and blood analysis was done, and is still done today, by electrochemistry, although there are other ways you can do it. You can do it by atomic absorption, graphite furnace. There are a lot of interferences. There's a lot of stuff in blood, okay, a lot of organic material in blood that causes problems when you're doing graphite furnace. But it's possible. Okay. What else? Inexpensive, portable, can take it out to sea, can buy it for a few thousand dollars. It does require a little bit of skill. You know, some biologists can handle it, some can't. But chemists, okay, can learn and do electrochemistry. Okay, inert metal complexes are not measured, free metal ion only. I talked to you about that before when we talked about polarography. I said that it only measures the free ion activity, right? Similar is the case with ASV. When I do the experiment, I'm plating out the free metal ion, not any metal ion that might be bound. That's why the blood had to be digested with acid and destroy the organic material in it, because if it wasn't, you would be measuring only the lead that was not bound to heme complexes or transferrin or other plasma proteins that are found in blood. Okay, if the lead was bound to something, it wouldn't show up. So in all of electrochemistry, we only measure the free ion, and if we have a complexes of the metal, then we have to free up the metal by destroying the complex, breaking up the complex somehow, and then converting all the metal to free metal, and then analyzing it. Now, there's a little bit of a subtlety here, and I didn't really mention it, but and that is the idea that the time scale of the measurement is also important, because complexes, as I indicated, I think, to you before, if I bind some of the lead, if I have some of the lead bound to something, then I try to plate it onto my electrode, the equilibrium that controls the binding of the lead will shift. If I remove some lead, the equilibrium will shift to free up more lead. The time scale of the measurement and the kinetics of the binding process are actually important here. And I'm not going to go into it in any detail, but just to say to you that every experiment has a time scale. It has some millisecond, nanosecond, whatever time scale over which it's conducted. That's true with NMR, right? You talk about the time scale of the NMR measurement. Or same is true with electrochemistry. If I'm doing rapid potential scans and fast pulses, I have a rapid time scale, a short time scale. If I'm doing just plating, I have a long time scale. All right? And that may influence the kinetics of the processes that we're trying to measure. Okay, let me just say we can also do cathodic stripping. Cathodic stripping? Yeah. That would be where I plate at a positive potential. What are you going to get to plate out at a positive potential? Negative ions. Okay? Things like molybdate and chromate and vanadate and arsenate and selenate and all those eights. You know? All those eights. Okay? They're all going to plate out, all the eights. Okay? If they're negatively charged, they would be attracted to a positively polarized electrode. So I can set the potential to a positive value, plate out negative things. Now, what do they do? It's like that anodizing experiment I told you about before where we anodized a silver wire with chloride and we produced silver chloride on the surface. You're really doing the same thing here. Typically use a mercury electrode, anodize or give a positive potential, get negative things to adsorb or stick. By the way, this is sometimes referred to, it does say it here. It's sometimes referred to as adsorptive stripping voltammetry or cathodic stripping. Either one of those names works. Because how is that stuff held to the surface of the electrode? Well, it's adsorption. It's not like lead ion going to lead metal and depositing. I understand that process. A negative ion being attracted to a positive electrode, it's just probably sticking by some adsorption process. Right? Then, once I concentrate those negative ions onto the positive electrode by holding the electrode constant at a positive potential for some period of time, then I scan in a negative direction, a cathodic direction, and I do cathodic stripping. I strip them off, and I see peaks, big peaks, because I concentrated the material, and I've now done cathodic stripping voltammetry. Can you do differential pulse cathodic stripping voltammetry? Of course you can. All right. Can you do... that's as complicated as we'll get. All right. This is the last one. Please, no cheering from the audience, okay? This is the last electrochemical technique that we're going to talk about. All right? Square wave voltammetry. This is one of the most modern electrochemical techniques. It's about 20 years old. You say, that's not modern. It is based on a 200-year history of electrochemistry. So, in my lifetime, maybe even in your lifetime, square wave voltammetry was invented, and the person who is pretty much credited with the discovery, not so much, she didn't invent it so much as she developed the technique. Just like I don't think Hayarovsky actually invented polarography, but he developed it. He was the guy who said, hey, this is a good thing. I think I'll spend my life doing polarography. Well, a woman by the name of Janet Osterjung developed square wave voltammetry to pretty much what it is today. Janet Osterjung is, I believe, last I knew, she was working at NSF. She was a researcher for a long time in academia, University of Buffalo. Her husband is also an electrochemist, and she is still active, and she works for the National Science Foundation right now, I believe. But she developed square wave voltammetry, and sometimes it's referred to as Osterjung square wave voltammetry. And if you look at the handouts, there's papers by her demonstrating the utility and power of this technique. Now, it's very sensitive. As a matter of fact, you can do square wave voltammetry with the plating that we talked about with the anodic stripping voltammetry. So you can do a deposition step first and then do the square wave. Okay? So it even makes it more sensitive. It's very fast. Well, people like fast. You can do that whole 1 volt or 1,000 millivolt scale range in 0.5 seconds. Well, I can spare that kind of time. 0.5 seconds? No problem. Okay? Can be used with any type of electrode. Can be used with the pre-concentration step I mentioned. Hey, what's going on? Uses a large amplitude square wave, and all I want you to do is just memorize that equation. Okay, let's move right along. You don't have to memorize that equation. But that is the equation, okay, for that describes the current in square wave voltammetry. NFA, diffusion coefficient, we know all those things. Concentration, right? Pi, you know all that, right? I'll talk to you a little bit about what these other parameters are in just a minute. Here's some of them right here. Okay, so here's a square wave. Up, down, up, down, up, down. Okay, that's square wave voltammetry. Okay, you just keep applying that. It's going up. All right? As a matter of fact, if you look at the average of the up and down, that's one cycle, right? So, hey, we're cycling. We're doing like a almost like an AC wave. But it's a pulse. It's a square pulse, positive and negative, okay? And there's, if we average that out, we've got an average potential. So this, you know what they call that? Staircase voltammetry. You know what they call that? The professor being funny. Okay. All right. So we have staircase voltammetry. All right. And that's actually a technique that somebody invented and named. But we're applying a square wave on top of that. All right. Cathodic pulse, anodic pulse. What are we doing? When it comes to measurement, we're only measuring in the end of the pulse. Okay. We're only measuring at the end of the pulse. The size of these steps that I was calling staircase steps, that's what ES is. See ES? That's what it is. Okay? It's the size of those steps as we increase the average pulse. EP, that's this thing right here. That's the size of the pulse. All right? There's staircase. Staircase wave. There's the square wave. We combine the two. And we get this. All right. Tau is the distance between the pulses, between the cycles. Right? How many cycles per second? So that's like the frequency. So we got N, F, A, D, C, pi. We've seen all that. We just saw tau, ES, and EP. Okay. Now, it actually tells you that psi, that's psi. No, that's a Greek symbol, psi. Is actually a function of ES and EP, right? And hello, oh okay, there it is. So you knew this already. You had this already on your. See, I should look at these slides once in a while. Okay, so pulse frequencies are about 200 hertz. Fast frequency, fast scan. Fairly large pulses, all right, and that's square wave voltammetry. Oh, look at that. Measure current at 1 and 2. All right. Since we do a complete cycle in square wave voltammetry, it's almost like doing cyclic voltammetry. And so if we were to measure the current, but here's the funny thing. In cyclic voltammetry, we got a peak in the forward scan and a peak in the reverse scan. In square wave voltammetry, we're taking those two peaks and we're summing them together. We're taking the overall current. So this would be like the forward scan, and this would be like the reverse scan, and this is the sum of the two. It says here it's the difference of the two. But since one is negative, if I subtract the negative, It's the same as adding. Okay? It's basic, right? So, if I subtract B from A, or what is I2 from I1, since I2 is a negative current, then it's like adding it. So it's subtracting a negative I2 from I1 to get me the overall delta I. So I get some added signal just because I'm doing this pulse up, pulse down, measuring the current forward and reverse, and I get a bigger pulse. I get a double-sized peak just because of that. Right? Okay. You don't seem too excited about that. The voltammogram is obtained in 0.5 to 3 seconds. So I can scan, what did I say, 1,000 millivolts in 0.5 seconds. I can scan slower if I want to. It depends on what the frequency is that I'm applying those pulses or those square waves to. I can use a dropping mercury electrode, but I can also use a solid electrode. All right. For a reversible reaction, the size of the pulse is large enough to cause reduction in one direction, oxidation in the reverse direction, and then I get the forward and reverse scan, and I get 2 times the current. We do get an E1/2, a peak at the E1/2, and the detection limits are 10 to the minus 8th without plating. So, in other words, in a second, in a 1 second experiment, I can get 10 to the minus 8th sensitivity, or if I'm dealing with metals and things, I can plate them out and get even greater sensitivity. 10 to the minus 10, 10 to the minus 12, whatever. Okay, it depends on how much I played out. Okay. Since I have time left and slides left, I'm going to keep talking, all right? Let me just summarize and say that there are many analytical applications of electrochemistry. We've talked a lot about quantitative analysis. So somebody brings you a sample and says, I want you to analyze this. That's bulk analysis of samples in the lab. We can also use electrochemistry for in situ or in situ, depending on how you like to pronounce that word. It means in the sample, right? In the environment. So I can take electrochemistry and I can take it to the environment and I can stick my electrodes in the water down by the river and measure some species in that river water. I can take the electrochemistry and I can stick it into somebody's head. There's a guy from, I think it's University of Kansas. I think his name was Ralph Adams. And he used to make electrodes the size of syringe needles, and he'd take these poor little rats, okay, laboratory rats, and he'd stick the needles in their head and do electrochemistry of their brain, the neurotransmitters in their brain. You know, epinephrine, norepinephrine, all those neurotransmitters that make us do crazy things, okay? Make rats do crazy things, okay? Well, he would have these rats with electrodes sticking out of their brain, and while he'd say, here, little rat, I've got some candy for you, and they would come over and he'd stick an electrode in the side of their head, and he'd measure their response while they were eating candy, okay, while he was torturing them with sticking needles in them, you know, all different things, okay? And so you could do in vivo or a type of experiments. You could do clinical applications of all sorts. You could do process control. You can actually have pipelines in a factory or a chemical plant, and you're monitoring them by looking at the electrochemistry of material passing through the pipeline. So different than bulk analysis, where you take a sample and bring it back to the laboratory and analyze it, you do something as a sensor in situ, and that's a big deal today. Even though sensors in electrochemistry have been around for, you know, a long time, 50 years. Then there's flow-through systems, like we do if we want to do HPLC, if we want to do electrochemical detection for HPLC. So we build a little flow-through detector and put it at the end of our HPLC, and the sample flows through, passes over a couple of electrodes. We do the chronoamperometry experiment, or we could do a pulsed experiment. We could do square wave if we're doing it fast. We could probably measure many pulses. If I can measure the entire scan in 0.5 seconds, I can certainly do electrochemistry on a peak that's coming out of an HPLC instrument, out of a column, because the flow rates at a milliliter per minute are fairly slow, and we can do the electrochemistry. We can do a technique called flow injection analysis. I mentioned pipelines already and process control. I mentioned that electrochemistry does measure species, right? Free versus bound metal. So electrochemistry has the ability to do speciation. We can study the mechanisms of reactions like we did with cyclic voltammetry, and we saw extra peaks in there, and that meant there was additional oxidation reduction reactions going on. I talked about reagent cleanup and pre-concentration. What else? Okay, here's a little slide on what kind of experiments would you do in electrochemistry if you were using a flow cell and doing flow injection analysis or HPLC. Well, you'd use a low-volume cell. The working electrode would be upstream from a reference and a counter electrode downstream, because the working electrode is the important thing, so you want the sample to hit that first. And then you could measure conductance. You could do the amperometry experiment, hold the potential fixed, and just look at what current is measured or is generated because of a oxidation or reduction reaction. We could do a fast scan voltammetry method like square wave that we just talked about, or we could do a coulometry experiment where we count the coulombs of while we convert one species to another. So those are different experiments that you could do in a flow-through type system. I mentioned here a couple of frontiers. You say this electrochemistry stuff is old, it's been around for a long time. That's true. But there are frontiers in electrochemistry. What are people doing now? Well, they're using rotating electrodes. I said, well, you use those already, yes. But then they're using rotating ring disk electrodes, where we have two electrodes, one in the middle, and then another one on the outside. And the material, here's a rotating system, right? Your potentiostat, your three electrodes, okay? This one's spinning around. And watch this. Are you impressed? It's just some GIF file that I got off of the internet. Okay. So as the if I've got a ring and a disk, right? If I've got a disk in the middle and a ring around the outside, and that's what this electrode is, then when stuff comes up, it hits the disk and then flows out to the ring. So I can do oxidation at the disk and reduction at the ring, or vice versa. Okay, so I can do that kind of experiment with a ring disk electrode system. So that's what I was talking about with frontiers in electrochemistry. It's like cyclic voltammetry, but we're oxidizing and reducing at two different electrodes. All right, what else we got here? We can do membrane-covered electrodes. If I'm worried about stuff that's going to foul my electrode, I can cover the electrode with a membrane, and that will prevent certain species from getting onto the surface of the electrode. If it's a large molecule, I can put a membrane that has small pores, and the large molecules won't touch the electrode surface. I can chemically modify the electrode. I can covalently bond things to the surface of the electrode, and then look at their chemistry or look at their ability to react with things in solution and the electrochemistry of the resulting products. I can use conducting polymers as electrodes, but I don't know anything about those. And then I can do ultra-micro electrodes, okay? Use very, very tiny electrodes. Sometimes they're called ultra-micro or micro electrodes. In the 20 micron range, typically having a hemispherical shape. And I get several interesting characteristics by using these very small electrodes. There's a short diffusion path for the species to diffuse. Very fast mass transport rates occur. Steady state conditions are established in a microsecond. You don't need convective mass. You don't even need a stir. You get good sensitivity without stirring, and stirring doesn't help you any. The IR drop becomes very low because the currents are very low, and low capacitive current. You can even use low ionic strength. You don't even have to have as much.